Rich is looking for a tune to dance to. I don't think he found it. It's a bit of a dirge, isn't it, Liz? Well, anyway, well. Oh, it goes into Sweet Dreams Are Made of These, little Eurythmics. Well, can you bring it up? Is it still playing?
Oh, that's a whole different.
There you go, Rich.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go to it, man. Right. Thank you, Liz. Appreciate it. Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel. That's great. Welcome to our program. A couple of notes. First of all, thank you to the wonderful people at Tanglewood, to Mark Volpe, to Bernadette Horgan, to Tony Fogg, to Taryn Watt for making yesterday such a special, beautiful day.
And to you, and especially to Sarah, because, you know, Sarah makes it look good for all of us.
Absolutely.
And, you know.
Well, and thanks to you for letting us go.
Oh, come on.
Well, no, I mean, that's camp.
I love Camp Tanglewood. I love it.
We had a great time, and Mark and Kevin Moran from the Berkshire Eagle,
yeah.
Alan, myself, we made up the panel yesterday. And it was different, but we had a great time and met all of the bright lights happening at Tanglewood and the Tanglewood on Parade last night. So just our thanks to them for making a very, very special day. I was noting during the BBC News at the top of the hour as I heard their lead story of the BBC, which was about a soccer player who is leaving the team, not because of a rape or a murder or anything horrible, but because of a contract negotiation. And I thought to myself, how lovely to live in that country where that's the top story of the day. So we have nothing as scintillating as that. We have all kinds of other stuff to discuss this morning, and we will do that in just a minute. Let me introduce our panel to you. On my left and to your left on the radio, left probably a good place, is... Teresa Bourgeois.
Yeah, what makes you say that?
She is a communications consultant and a regular panelist on this program, and we are thrilled to have her today, and she'll be here tomorrow as well, and thank you very much for being here.
Delighted to be here and on the left.
Yes.
So when you're a communications consultant, what do you tell people to do? Give us an example of what a communication
is. Buy low, sell high, that kind of stuff? No.
No. I wish I knew that kind of consulting. I do public relations mostly. I work with companies who... often, most of them are early startups, or I work with some book authors to try to help them get proper press for what they do.
Great,
so,
great.
Press releases, speeches, things like that.
And then in the center of your radio dial is the...
It's center the, right of your radio
dial. Is the one and only Rich Honan, a corporate attorney at law. And it's always great to have Rich.
I kind of like attorney of law.
Of
I
law.
Like the way that sounds. Now.
Sounds
well,
good.
What do you do?
I don't do anything.
You get them out of legal trouble that I help them talk about. Right?
Yes, I seem to spend most of my day fielding administrative requests from the home office. Yesterday, I had a bunch of emails on the new furniture for the Albany office. So that took.
Whoa.
Doesn't get more exciting than that.
That took all of my 30 years of legal experience right there to deal with that one.
That was impressive.
So we welcome you. Thank you very much. Alan Chartok is with us, and we are, and he's not right. He's not left. He is just here, omnipresent.
That's
true?
Very nice. Omnipresent is probably the word a lot of people would use.
Well, it's accurate. You're
he
here,
never
you're,
goes away.
Oh, I didn't mean it like that. All right. Well, welcome. Let's go to the our topics and what we have going on. Let us begin with the story about the Justice Department to take on affirmative action in college admissions. This seems like a good one to start off with. The Trump administration is preparing to redirect resources of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division toward investigating and suing universities over affirmative action admissions policies deemed to discriminate against white applicants. That according to a document obtained by the New York Times. The document, an internal announcement to the Civil Rights Division, says lawyers, current lawyers, interested in working for a new project on investigations and possible litigation related to intentional race-based discrimination in college and university admissions. The announcement suggests that the project will be run out of the division's front office, where the Trump administration's political appointees work, rather than its educational opportunity section, which is run by career civil servants and normally handles work involving schools and universities. Alan.
Well, I've been thinking about this a little bit. Obviously, African Americans were brought here in chains. They were enslaved. They were oppressed. And that has continued to this very day. And because of the color of their skin, because of their skin pigment, they have been kept down. We know that. It's not debatable. Now, what happens is, along comes Trump, he gets elected, and he says to the African-American community, elect me, what have you got to lose? Now they know what they have to lose. The health care, you know, the way in which progressive legislation may or may not be canned. And there are those African-Americans who think that based on the history of repression and everything else in this country, that they ought to be getting reparations. Their argument is, hey, you did this to us. We didn't do it ourselves. You've kept it going all of these years. We ought to be getting reparations for what we have, what we and our families and our parents have suffered during that time. It's another whole story. Where I'm coming from is one of the ways in which we can create equality of opportunity, which is something that even Republicans believe in, equality of opportunity. One of the ways we can do that is to make sure that everybody is playing on an equal educational playing field. The Supreme Court, of course, has checked in on this. They're not happy about giving giving a special break to African Americans. So here we are. Obviously, Trump, who has been at war with the poor, at war with people of color in this country since he took over, despite what he may have said to either poor people or to gay people on a different front, they're doing that. So that's the way I would set it up, Joe and panel. I would say, if there is no equality of opportunity, real opportunity, you have to make it.
Teresa.
Well, I think that if you appoint Jeff Sessions as the U.S. Attorney General, sure, and if you appoint Betsy DeVos as your Secretary of, yep, Education, then policies like this follow. And if you elect Donald Trump as your president, who, you know, just think about what think about the day he came down the elevator at Trump Tower and announced that he was running, and think about the tone he set there, which was a tone of division and of, you know, us and them. And so we just had 8 years of a we president, you know, it's, we're all in this together, and we elected an us and them president. And this is what you get. Just like today, there'll be a event at the White House on immigration, and it will definitely be a divisive conversation. And the transgender policy is a divisive policy. And this is a divisive policy. And this is the consequences of electing Donald Trump. This is not a surprise. It's discouraging. It's not where I think we should be moving as a country. But it's the consequences of electing Donald Trump.
When you said we president, Rich's eyes got so big. He went like this, just...
Oh, my
go,
God.
Go ahead.
Well, there's no doubt that Barack Obama spent 8 years trying to talk about us coming together as a country.
Inclusion.
Talked about inclusion and working together and focused on healing wounds. And there's absolutely no doubt that throughout his election and in these first 6 months, what Donald Trump has done.
Hey, that's
fine. Hello.
Sorry about that.
Is talked about divisions.
One last thing before Rich goes, and that is, nothing heartened me more than to see the name of Deval Patrick coming up this morning as a potential presidential candidate, who I truly love the man. I mean, I love him, and wonderful family, wonderful wife, and I think the expectation there would be things would severely change and we would be back to we if Deval Patrick wins. Rich, I'm sorry for getting in front of you.
So on the issue of when it comes to affirmative action and what is being done by the Justice Department, with your legal background, what do you make of this?
Well, I think, affirmative act, I think affirmative action is a program that I think everybody, well, I'll speak for everybody, agrees was certainly well-intentioned. It hasn't fully panned out, I think, the way it was expected to. I think there were some unintended consequences. Yes, I understand. I understand the conservative narrative that at some level affirmative action is legalized discrimination, and I kind of get that. But I also agree, I think, with the larger point that there was a history of inequity, and
it's carried forward, right?
I do not think we have slavery anymore. I do not think that we have full equality of everyone.
But do you think there's economic oppression? Do you think that there is that there's prejudice in this country that has led to a very bad divided group of people in this country?
I think there's prejudice in this country. I know when I was growing up, we were taught never to discriminate on somebody based upon the color of their skin or their economic status. And I feel often when I'm here, I get discriminated against based on the color of my skin and my economic status. And I'm sure other people feel that way based on the color of their skin and their economic status. So I believe there's still prejudice in America. I don't have a huge problem. I know this departs from the conservative narrative. I don't have a huge problem with affirmative action. I understand that there was a true problem that everyone agrees was a problem, and it was basically the inequality of opportunity. Affirmative action was a way of trying to combat that. Do I think it's gone a little too far, like everything else in the government? Sure. Yeah, I do.
So where?
What I would say, Alan, is I actually, again, drawing on my conservative principles, I think colleges, for the most part, if they should run their programs the way they want to run their programs,
sure.
If they believe that they want to base their school on increased diversity and that's what's important to them, that's fine. I do think that there have been some unintended consequences of affirmative action. I think we all know what they are.
Could you just go over them again?
Well, just the idea that what people did not think was that now people would be placed into a position and then the question would be, why are they there? Are they, unless they are an uber performer, unless they almost have to overperform.
Sure.
I'm talking in the earlier years.
You'd
have that pointing at them saying, it almost set a higher standard because they would be tagged with being, they're there because of affirmative action.
Right.
I think we're getting past that.
I think that's a really good point, which is a problem of it, is that the assumption is that a minority that gets in because of preferential treatment is not qualified. But the flip side of affirmative action to let minorities in is that universities and colleges have always had preferential treatment. If your parents went there, you're more likely to get
legacy.
In. There's a whole series. If you're a good hockey player, you get in, whatever. There's always been preferential treatment, but the preferential treatment of minorities, I think, has been stigmatized. And that's, I think, what you're getting at. And that's a problem as well.
Well, one last part of this is the political part. You can be sure that the White House, which is trying to inflame that base constantly, that so-called base, has done polling on this. And that white Americans, many white middle-class Americans, when presented with a question, do you think it's right that your kid has to step out of line and somebody should go in front of them because of the color of their skin? And they're going to say, hell no. That's what they're going to say. And the White House is capitalized. This isn't Alan speaking. This is what I think is happening politically. This is the Bannon base. This is the people you try to inflame. Once you know that they're there and that that's their position, that's where you're going.
And there is genuine frustration, I think, among working class white families who, they want their kid to go to college and they think, well, they can't get in because somebody else, a minority person, got preferential treatment. And that's where I was talking about the, we versus us and them dynamic, because if you had a national conversation that, you know, we're all welcome, you can work to heal those wounds and address those. But if you make it confrontational, you know, us against them, then you pick at that scab and you exacerbate those
sure.
tensions.
That's right.
And but there are very legitimate concerns among some people, particularly I think it tends to fall on working class white people who feel like now, you know, they don't get a break because, you know, they're not wealthy and white, they're not poor and minority, they're just, you know, stuck in the middle and don't get a break.
I agreed. And I think the other larger policy issue with affirmative action that we on the right have is it addresses a known problem, but I think it addresses the problem too late in the process. Affirmative action is built on this idea that if you're a poor kid who lives in a poor community who goes to a school that doesn't have the resources, it's not fair to say, well, you know, you have to get X on your SATs, you know, because it's not really putting you at the same level as kids who have had all the resources.
Tell that to Deval Patrick, who went to Milton Academy, who had this leg up as a result of, you know, a very bright kid who gets this extra break and is now being talked about as a president in the United States.
Right.
Yeah, it's great.
His doors were open.
But I'm saying I think the place to address it, I think the efforts are probably better directed, you know, at the root causes, right? At fixing the poor communities, the poor schools, and you know, trying to break that differentiation.
Let's pause there. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll have letters and we'll talk more about this and other subjects as well. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. I like it. Very nice. Thank you. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Nice to have you with us on this Wednesday morning. And we welcome you, Alan Chartok, Rich Honan, and Teresa Bourgeois, making up the panel. I'm Joe Donahue. Alan has a fistful of letters, and he is going to read them to us right now.
Right. I've been talking to Rich about his ownership of horses. Rich owns.
Yeah.
Rich,
oh, he just winced. Oh, look at that.
Oh, well, okay.
Yeah,
so
just keep reading.
Have said anything. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Barbara says, hi, panel. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. The phrase is institutionalized racism. That's the continuation of our slavery legacy. Rich, I am, and these are capital letters now, Rich, I am so very sorry that you feel discriminated against due to your skin color and economic status. We'll all try to do better. Barbara from Staten Island and Saugerty.
I appreciate it, Barbara. Work on it.
Okay, good morning. Alan is right. The Trump administration could not be more transparent in their attempts to appeal to the bigots, which compromise a lot of his base. Kick transgenders out of the military. Eliminate attempts to help black people get equal access to higher education. Rich, you talk about root causes as if he cares. It's all just red meat designed to play on the fears of the lower class white male who sadly feels left behind by the march of social progress. Well, you were saying something, Teresa, weren't you, about middle class whites who have a sense of being wronged?
Right. So that's the challenge here, that you can't ignore the fact that there is some frustration among working class whites. And how do you address that at the same time that you deal with these very real barriers against highly qualified African-American people, you know, students? And the way you do it, I think, is the President, I prefer the President Obama approach, where you talk about making room for everybody and implement that with your policies. Yet you have President Trump and Jeff Sessions now, you know, going to sue the universities. At the same time, he presents a budget that cuts key programs in the Department of Education.
Mm-hmm.
That there's programs called, you know, the details don't matter, but gear up different programs to create avenues of opportunity for people who traditionally have, you know, have, because of their economic status or their, you know, because they are African Americans or Latinos who have been discriminated against.
Yeah. But okay. But look, if you go to City College or City College, which I did, and you have an 85 average, you get in. anybody gets in who has an 85 average. There's some problems with that because some schools are more difficult than others to get an 85 average in, but you have an 85 average, you get in. But then what happens when you say you don't need an 85 average? What happens when you say you need if you're black, you need an 82 average, whereas somebody else's kid doesn't get in as a result of that? That's where the anger comes.
Yeah, and I think the other place, I don't know if I'd use the word anger, frustration. I think the other thing that you're seeing, and I'm seeing this, you know, even in the Gilderland School District, I won't mention his name, but one of my son's good friends who actually works, who actually interned with Barbara.
Barbara Smith?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He mounted kind of a campaign for the school to be more transparent and a little bit more realistic in giving credit. So you say you have your 85 average, but how do you judge that 85 average with the student who takes all core classes versus the student who takes the AP and the honors classes? Now they get an 80, right? Because they chose to take a harder class. Aren't you disincenting people?
Well, no, you're right. There's always going to be inequities based on different places people came from. There are school systems, colleges, which have said, okay, the way we're going to do this is if you're in the upper fifth of your high school class, you get in. And so there are some high school classes which are just much easier than if you went to Bronx High School of Science.
Right. I was going to say, if you go to Bronx Science, you know, the upper fifth is pretty tough.
Right. But yeah, I mean, but you know, the Harvards of the world have been working aggressively. At least they appear to be working aggressively
to get the best minority students in the country,
right? And to open up opportunities and create pathways, so that they have, you know, their summer programs. MIT has long had summer programs. Johns Hopkins, a whole host of universities, to provide early exposure to people to go to college. People who are economically disadvantaged or people who typically have not been as welcomed in these universities. And the problem is, and Rich alluded to it earlier, that you might have some highly qualified people who are African-American or Latino who didn't get just the 85, they got the 95, but in the past had not been getting in. And now they've got the 95, they get in, and the presumption is they got in because of some preference.
Yeah, that's a terrible thing.
That's the problem. Yeah, that's the problem. And so often the people who are getting in are highly qualified.
Okay, so moving on the letters. Could General Kelly's ascent mean that Kelly is really the president and that our official president is simply meeting reality, that a dictatorial CEO is finding out that it's not the same job when dealing with the messiness of democracy? Maybe Kelly is today's Eisenhower, but with a different label. Maybe Kelly, in the end, will save the nation. That's from Chaz.
I would think it would be more George Marshall, wouldn't it?
But also,
seems overly, like an overly optimistic letter, but go ahead.
You know, I've been thinking about this a lot. I'm really worried about the military model. It's not that we don't have a good man here. I think everybody agrees he is. But what about the next one? I mean, you know, once the military... the separation between, you know, civilians and militaries gets obscured, even by a guy who is the best of intention and is really obviously a very good man. What do you expect next up is going to happen?
Well, the other thing, you know, I'm pleased that he's there because I think we're at a danger point and we need some order in the White House, and I think he will bring order. But there was a very interesting piece in Esquire by Charlie Pierce. He wrote eloquently what I've been trying to articulate, is that everybody's focused on he's a general. And do you want a general in the White House? And that's, I know, been your focus, Alan. But he's also very conservative. And think about what he did at Homeland Security. Think about the hard stance he took on the immigration issues. Think about the hard stance he's taken, you know, with ICE. And so, so we have to look at not just that he's going to be orderly, which I think our country needs right now. I think we're in a danger zone and we need that. But he is in his time, I don't know if it's total 6 months, but in his time at Homeland Security, he clearly is very, very conservative in his ways. Or he was just implementing what Trump, following the rules of Trump.
So I love what you're saying, and here's why. So could it be that he is the hope, that he comes in and that he says, okay, Scaramucci, you're out. which we think happens. And also that we see, it's been a little while, you pointed this out during the break, Teresa, that there is not a, that they're not...
not been a tweet for 23 hours.
He's not tweeting for 23 hours. Maybe he said that was condition number two. Now he saves the Trump presidency. Are you following
bum,
me?
Ba-da-bum.
Yeah, he saves the Trump presidency. And all the bad things that Trump stands for, he may, in fact, be helping to have happen because Trump isn't making a jerk of himself.
Okay, so I said that, and now he's tweeted.
Okay, and the craziness level on it
No.
I think that's proof positive that Trump listens to the roundtable.
Yes, yeah. I think you're right.
That's right.
We're going to completely take credit for that.
He and I spoke earlier, and I told him we'd be on.
You mean he doesn't?
So what was the tweet?
He couldn't go a full 24 hours. He almost made it 24. He made it 23. And this is a polite tweet, although he's making me mad here. Small business owners are the dreamers and innovators who are powering us into the future. Read more and watch here. So why would that make me mad? That's a very presidential.
I was going to ask you that very question.
How odd. So I listened to the small business event that they did yesterday at the White House, President Trump and Ivanka Trump and Linda McMahon. And it was all very lovely about how much they support small business and how we need to grow small business and all of that. That's lovely, except for if you compare it with the budget that they have proposed for the Small Business Administration. And if you think about what they're doing to small business with their health care proposals, they proposed only a 5% cut. But much of that, the vast majority of that 5% cut in the Small Business Administration budget was targeted to microloans, micro enterprises, minority business programs, and education and outreach. Those very programs that will help women and minority businesses and local startups to get the tools that they need to survive and thrive and then hire other people. And Rich, I think, you know, you're in this business of helping startups and young companies. And so I bet you know very well how important these early startup initiatives are.
Yeah, they are. And I think the Trump administration would respond by saying we've been able to help not only small businesses, but all businesses demonstrably, not by spending money, but through the regulatory process. The rolling back of the Obama era regulations on trying to reclassify people as, management employees and increasing overtime and things like that. Once those got rolled back, you saw how the job numbers jumped. You see how they tried to roll back some of the regulatory compliance parts of
like
Obamacare.
Like on Roundup, for instance?
Like, I'm sorry?
Regulatory issues like on Roundup and that kind of thing.
I don't know what Roundup is.
Roundup is a chemical.
Oh! Roundup. You mean the stuff that you spray on your?
I thought it was like a Roundup.
Yeah, I did too. I'm sorry.
Like a rodeo
kind of
thing.
But everybody says, "Oh, isn't it great that they're rolling back these regulations?" But you have to look at what they're rolling back.
I don't use pesticides in my lawn, which is probably why my garden is so bad.
But to your point, the Dow just went over 22, so I'm sure they'll be celebrating.
No, but the point is that you can make things better for business without necessarily giving businesses money. You can make things better for business by creating a better business environment.
Well, then why are they keeping the supports?
No, go ahead.
Sorry. Why are they choosing to keep the supports targeted not toward minority or women businesses or local startup businesses and cutting out those programs? I mean, they're making choices and think about the choices. And I'm, reading this from a small business organization who did an assessment of these cuts and said that they're targeted to weaken efforts, particularly in urban and rural areas, to promote startups that then, and they say these investments more than pay for themselves by the jobs that these small businesses create.
Yeah. We're desperately late for a break where we have to go and listen to small businesses who have supported this radio station. We'll be right back after this. I love, 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 love that the cynicism gets even thicker during the breaks. All right, let's go back to the letters.
Mike said, at the beginning of the film MacArthur, Gregory Peck, portraying the general, addresses the cadets at West Point with these words, quote, duty, honor, country, Those three hallowed words reverently dictate what you ought to be, what you can be, and what you will be. Rich, I am struggling to find out what honorable thing Donald Trump has done since he came down the escalator at Trump Tower in 2015. Can you help?
Has the ceasefire in Syria held? I think it has. Have there been chemical attacks on innocent Syrians since the military actions he's taken? No, there have not. Has he been fighting to relieve the people of Mosul from, you know, the threat of ISIS? Yes, he has. I think those are just a couple of the things.
Domestically,
and going back to our small business, I think he has helped roll back regulations that have allowed small businesses to now hire more people, and you can't argue with the numbers. They're hiring. Yeah, I understand that wage growth still very stagnant. I understand that, but
not for people at the top.
Well, never. Yeah, but
the
but,
income disparity is dramatically increasing.
Yeah, I don't think it's increasing. I actually think that the reason why they say it's increasing is because now there's more people actually in the workforce and, you know, coming in at the lower levels, and those people weren't counted when they were on the unemployment rolls. They weren't counted in the calculation of income disparity. So I actually think that that's the answer to your question. I think that's one of the things he's done that's helped a lot.
John says, since the Supreme Court's Bakke decision in the 1970s, racial quotas and purely race-based administration to universities has been illegal. As Alan mentioned, there's a long legacy of race-based discrimination in our country. The flip side of that is that whites have been favored in many areas of life, including in college admission. So, unless all of the opponents of affirmative action are also opponents of legacies in college admissions, they have absolutely no credibility in screaming discrimination just because they see a few black people at their school. And that's from John. Mark says, stats show that a white job candidate who is an ex-con has a better chance of employment than a black person with a clean record. Rich, is there there's no racism?
I don't think I said there was no racism.
You did not.
Okay. You very carefully.
What'd you say?
He was very careful to say that you agree this is a problem, right?
Yeah. Sean said, in regards to Allen's claim for equality of races, it was only a tiny minority of elite that had slaves. Only 1.6% of Americans owned slaves at its peak in 1860. My Italian ancestors were as far from owning slaves as they were from getting affirmative action entitlements. Interesting to note, after 60 years of entitlements to help the poor and oppressed rise up in this country, the number of families living in poverty hasn't decreased since 1960. Has it become more of a handout rather than a hand up, a crutch to becoming independent from government support? Some say they are being kept on a plantation with entitlements, the government plantation.
Yeah, that's interesting because I just said I was speaking to a group of conservatives and we're talking about the same concept of lower income people being being kept in the inner cities in the same type of way, obviously not by design.
Yeah, but what about
it is by design though.
Mm-hmm. I would argue that you're right, but not from the design on my side of the aisle. Most of these inner cities are not run by Republican administrations.
But what about the fact? So, for instance, I heard an interesting stat yesterday. Affordable housing. The affordable housing works best when it's mixed use. And there are all sorts of tax credits for affordable housing, but it works best when it's mixed use. But I heard only 3% of the tax credits go to genuine mixed use housing. That means you mix in affordable rents with others. A person was saying that he builds his housing. He can't break into wealthier neighborhoods. He's not allowed to build in wealthier neighborhoods.
I was going to say, when you said
That's a federal directive.
It's not only
and a
federal.
State directive.
It's federal. It's state. No, and it has. You know, I think there's developers jumping up and down right now about that whole mixed use issue, for that because they are actually saying that because cities and mainly cities, based on edicts from the federal government and then amplified by the cities, are making these mixed use development requirements. What they're really doing is stopping developers from being able to build better houses in low-income areas because nobody wants to buy into these mixed-use developments. They want to just build houses, and they can't do it because the cities are imposing requirements on them. I think it's a perfect example of a misguided policy that's actually counterintuitively stopping.
I don't get it. So you would have them do what? In other words, you say it's a misguided policy. What would you have them do? Not try?
No, I would say if a developer comes in and he says, I want to build low-income housing, let them build low-income housing.
Yes, but we've seen that that's a failure because these are breeding grounds for crime and everything else. These gigantic, we're taking them down in Albany, we're taking them down in New York City. So the whole idea is, Teresa, I think, said correctly, what does work is integrating, poor and those people who have more.
But first of all, there's no indication that actually works because those projects aren't getting built because people aren't doing the mixed-use
projects. Because the guys who are doing the building are racist.
Okay. Well, if that's the answer, then that's always the answer.
Okay. Alan. Well, that is the answer. Okay. So then what about skin pigment? The Italian argument here was my people, got off their haunches or whatever and worked hard and blacks can't. But it's skin pigment, don't you see? I mean, I hear it from my Jewish friends. I hear it from it's the fact that these people are identified by the color of their skin. That's the nature of prejudice. Read Gordon Allport.
Right. But I don't think anybody's arguing that, Alan. I think what people are arguing is...
Well, he argued it. What he's saying is my Italian family overcame this.
Well, I think part of what he's saying, though, is that there's a series of policies that are meant to help, and he's questioning, and I don't think from a racist standpoint, he is questioning... Are these policies really helping?
I didn't call them a racist.
We talked about affirmative action. Affirmative action is actually, I think, before Great Society.
Okay, Rich.
I think it's actually Kennedy.
Okay, Rich.
Right?
Has
that been helping?
Okay, Rich, just so we all understand, you would solve the problems of institutional and other kinds of racism in this country by?
First of all, I don't know that I could solve any of those problems. I would address the problems... a little differently. I would address the problems rather than by subsidizing the issues, by more directly confronting the issues.
Like, go ahead, just fill it in for us.
I would go into places like the schools, the public schools,
yeah,
and say, why is it that those schools are failing? And is it because of the way they're being run? Is it really the money? Do we need to spend more money? I'm not sure that's the answer. But I have a feeling just from empirically seeing how the Great Society has gone over the last 40 years and the war on poverty has gone over the 50 years, it doesn't look to me like it's working. So I'm willing to look at other things, but I can't have that conversation because when I do, I get tagged as a racist. That's the issue.
Anybody?
Well, okay.
Joe, go ahead.
Alan's got letters.
What size shoe do you wear? Here we go. Good morning, panel, says Suzanne. The question is for Rich. I've been enlightened about the United States history regarding race by reading, Kinaga Yamahata's book, From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation.
I read that. Barbara made me read that.
I recall that
it was really, really good book.
I recall that you and Barbara read it too.
Yes.
I was wondering what you from it
or
what you learned.
She didn't make me read it. I asked Barbara and she encouraged me.
Okay. Hi, panel. Rich is right that affirmative action at the college level is too little too late. Research shows that there are very good policies that work to eliminate the achievement gap that would be good for working class whites too. Universal pre-K, free nutritious meals, access to quality health care, et cetera. Too bad they are an anathema to most conservative lawmakers who are eager to play white identity politics than deal with social problems. And that's from Brandon at the University of Albany.
I broke into Suzanne. So Suzanne was the woman who wrote the letter about Black Lives, the book. I can't pronounce the author's name, but From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. The question in her letter is, I was wondering what you took away from it or what you learned. And one of the things I learned was, and I've had this conversation with Barbara, is, you know, the extent to which if you are African-American that you that you the effects of that are marbled throughout kind of everything you do in your life every day. And that's something that I don't think is immediately, you know, to me, you know, as a white person, was not something immediately apparent. I think that's something I had a greater sensitivity to. I can't necessarily say empathy because I'm not experiencing it. But I think I came away from that book with a greater sensitivity to the fact of how your race is just marbled throughout your life.
And that it seems to be a part of what Keith is saying. Good morning, panel. We can see what happens when there are no affirmative action programs. Just look at the financial services and mortgage industries. We can see how that has turned out. African Americans are the most unbanked, lowest home ownership rates, and financially discriminated against. We need the federal government to step in and make our society better for the most vulnerable, and that's from Keith.
Remember, we have a president of the United States who early on, you know, his father, they did great. Not, you know, they got in trouble for not allowing African Americans to rent their apartments, right?
So let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have more letters. We have other stuff to discuss as well, and we will do that right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Let me reintroduce the panel to you for this Wednesday morning. It's 6 minutes after 10 o'clock on the 2nd of August. Alan Chartok is here. Rich Honan, Teresa Bourgeois. A few things. First of all, we'll get to more letters in a moment or two. We've been noticing a lot of letters not addressed to the right place. Please do not send your letters to any other address other than panel@wamc.org, because then they don't go into the right place, and then we don't get to read them on the air, and then you get mad at us.
Yeah, what's the matter with you?
panel@wamc.org. Been noticing a lot going into the wrong mailboxes, and we're not checking those, so please, 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 panel@wamc.org. While we're begging you, keep them short and to the point. Yeah. We joked a while ago and said 140 characters, but there is no joke, as Alan would
it's
say.
No joke.
Thank you. And so keep them short and to the point if you want us to go through them quickly. All right. With all of that said, we move on to other issues and talk about stuff, including the White House saying that Donald Trump weighed in on his son's Russia meeting. So that was the story we were talking about yesterday. Yes, 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 he did. And the statement from Sarah Huckabee Sanders during the press briefing yesterday was he did so, quote, as any father would.
He was a lying liar. And he denied it. And his lawyer got up there and keep playing him denying it over and over and over again. And so now when they get caught, they say, well, it's what any father would do. But in fact, you know, I don't think it's true. He's the president of the United States. It's a functioning system of nepotism in which the family is running everything. And he does stand up there and do that. I think it's disgusting. He just lied.
Rich,
again, you know, I don't care.
I don't know
that he lied. I don't know what he said. I don't know what the statements were. I think what they say in the letter that they ended up having a conversation about the
adoption,
the adoption thing, which is actually what happened.
What are you talking about?
That's what happened. That's why the meeting was. That's not the meeting they wanted.
Rich, stop that.
They thought they were going to a meeting.
We have the emails. We have the darned emails which say we're going to give you information about Hillary. Come on now.
So how is that inconsistent, Alan, with what I just said?
At the meeting. You just said it was really about adoption.
No.
That was a lie.
At the meeting,
yes.
They talked about adoption. The statement that they put out said, at the meeting, we talked about adoption. Now, it's true that they didn't want to talk about adoption. They wanted to talk about what dirt do you have on Hillary. But when it turned out that they were talking about adoption, that's when they gave up on the meeting.
Let's not use the code word adoption. Let's use the word Magnitsky Act. Yeah. And I know I got in trouble for not pronouncing it properly, so I hope I did.
It was Magnitsky.
Magnitsky Act.
All right.
Yeah, which is the sanctions.
Sanctions. Right.
This was the lawyer who was brought into America by the Obama administration and allowed to stay or something? Is that the same woman?
Let's not deviate from your basically incorrect idea.
Let's not confuse this with facts. This was a meeting which was
to get dirt on Hillary, and when it wasn't the dirt they thought they were going to get, they fled. Come on. And then Trump got up and he lied about Donald Jr., and he's been caught in the lie, and his lawyer lied, and he's been caught in the lie. Come on.
It was deceptive. It was misleading. He withheld the withheld information, reportedly did it contrary to the lawyer's advice, and consistent with the way Trump has operated over time in his
like
business,
said,
except for now
lying,
he's president of the United States.
Topic two, real quick, is that the stock market is now over 22,000, record high, and Dow Jones currently up 62.21. So
you know, Joe, I know all these guys, Great Barrington and others, whose fathers, they're old now. The guys I know are old, like me. But their fathers saw it coming, and they pulled out just in time in 1929. And those are the guys who really made a great deal of money and stayed rich for the rest of their lives.
Joe Kennedy was one, right? Didn't Joe Kennedy get out just before the 29 crash, like months before?
Yeah.
What do you make of the stock market? I don't understand it.
I'm not a stock market expert. Everybody thinks just because I'm a corporate lawyer, I'm a stock market expert.
But you're rich.
I think what is going on is
rich.
That the
Richie Rich.
You know, what they call the Trump trade. I think the increase has been from the market's correct assumption that no matter what happens, whether it, forget legislatively, the market has assumed there's going to be less burdensome regulation on American business. And that has been the fact.
But that's not much different than what I was saying to you during the break, which is if you just tell anybody that they any business that they can do whatever the hell they want to, don't worry about environmental rules, don't worry about trade rules, don't worry about anything, just go do it. If it's going to make money, obviously the stock market is going to well.
So right now, all of the clients of my firm are jumping up and down saying, wait, what do you mean there's no environmental rules anymore? There's no trade rules. The amount of environmental rules, of trade rules, of occupational self and safety rules, no, they're around. They will always be around. I think all what has been undone has been a lot of the Obama era regulations.
Can you describe two or three of them that have been undone that you think are
I think
are
in
important?
Order of importance, because you asked about the stock market, I think in order of importance to the stock market, the biggest one was the regulations involving the Department of Labor, which would have reclassified employees to basically make employees have to be paid overtime, management type employees to have to be paid overtime. And I'm terribly simplifying it because it's a lot of regulation, but it would have made. You would have had to rejigger your employment in such a way as to reclassify people, and then a lot of people
to pay your employees for the work that they're doing.
No, you would have had to. What you would have had to do is not be able to take management employees and have to pay them overtime rather than paying them as managers, you know, flat rate. And so what businesses were doing was like, okay, you're now a manager. Congratulations. Now you're working 29 hours a week instead of 40 or whatever it was. So that was one of the biggest ones. I think obviously the bank rules on the financial side, the bank rules in terms of the Volcker rule, the proprietary trading rules, you know, reducing those somewhat, I think has helped Wall Street, because now banks are doing they're actually trading on their own accounts, and of course that's going to make Wall Street more frothy.
After the great meltdown, we should really absolutely be rewarding with the banks kinds of wonderful perquisites, right?
Hey, listen, Alan, I don't disagree with you. I can think of no greater hypocrisy that the rule that was supposed to now rein in the banks is Dodd-Frank, named after the two guys who were supposed to be in charge of the committees in the House and Senate, respectively, who were supposed to be overseeing the banks in the first place. And after they totally dropped the ball on that job, we reward them by naming the new law after them. If anybody should have lost jobs, it should have been the two of them.
What?
Dodd-Frank, Barney Frank, Chris Dodd were the heads of the banking committees in the House and Senate. Yeah. And after totally being asleep at the wheel and allowing the CDS, allowing the credit default swap crisis to go ahead in a fully unregulated way, then they decide, well, we need a law to fix this. Yeah, yeah.
Didn't we? Didn't we need a law so that these guys can't do? These greedy bankers, all of whom, by the way, seem to be showing up in the Trump administration, or so many of them, So, and how come, Rich, if it's so true that Dodd-Frank was such a good thing for the banks and everybody else, how come the street and everybody else was so anxious to put a knife at its heart?
No, it was no. The Dodd-Frank was a bad thing for the banks. I understand,
and it was a good thing for consumers.
Maybe, except that the point. My point was the hypocrisy that these guys attached their name to the legislation after having been the people at the top of the government.
Please don't keep saying that.
Why? Say what?
It doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense.
They were in charge of the committees supposed to be regulating the banks.
And then
they shouldn't have had jobs after this.
And then they went and tried to do something better. They tried to fill in the holes in the way we were doing business.
Who was president of the United States? Who was
the derivative
trading rules and
the credit default swap rules and the rules of what you got to count as cash? Those were actual rules promulgated under the
George Bush's presidency.
Look, these guys were supposed to be in charge of the banks. The things that the banks did that ended up with most of those problems.
Because the George Bush administration did not step in, so Congress did.
Greed will out.
Okay, did you hear about this one? So the question.
Two guys go to a bar.
Two guys walk into a bar, and the one guy says, "Hey, why'd you walk into the bar? Didn't you see it standing there?" So, thank you. So.
That was funny, Joe.
I'll try. So the question that the Washington Post asks today on their front page is, can this marriage be saved? The relationship between Trump and the Senate GOP hits new skids. Where are we on this, ladies and gentlemen? The relationship between President Trump and Senate Republican has deteriorated so sharply in recent days that some are openly defying his directives, bringing long simmering tensions to a boil as the GOP labors to reorient its stalled legislative agenda.
So all of a sudden, what we're going to see now are the Republicans in the Senate, the moderate Republicans, getting together with the Democrats and saying, "Let's keep Obamacare, and we'll keep Obamacare, and we will make it better. We all know some things have to be done to it. Hooray!" And why did that happen? Because all of a sudden, somebody woke up one morning and said, "This guy's making such a jerk out of himself, Trump. That is, that we really have to be able to step in and save the country." And good for them.
What marriage?
The marriage between the GOP and
When was there ever a marriage between Trump and the GOP? Trump ran against these guys. Against the GOP establishment as he ran against the Democratic establishment. And he got in by calling them all out. And by the way, they ended up showing their true colors by what they did last week. There never was a marriage. Shouldn't be saved.
By the way, Rich. You weren't around during this healthcare thing when they blindly stayed with him despite the fact that he didn't have a program and he was really being a jerk about the whole thing. You forgot about that little thing that they were there, that the Republicans were in his pocket? So don't tell me that.
I don't think either Trump or the Republicans would agree they were in his pocket. The establishment Republicans never answered to Trump. He was the one who called them out and said, "You guys want to repeal?" They originally said they wanted to repeal Obamacare. He said, "No, I want to repeal and replace." Got a whole bunch of stuff from them after saying that. "Oh, you're not complying with conservative principles." And then when they were unable to do what they said they were going to do for 7 years, he called them out again.
So that was
never a marriage.
Okay, all right. So take the word marriage out of it. They were getting along and they were playing in the same sandbox.
How were they?
And they weren't letting the
marriage of convenience.
Okay, so
why were they doing that?
So what you're saying now is all of the Republicans, not all of the Republicans, but the Republicans who did support and showed loyalty to the president, who are now having questions and are turning, that is the story that we're talking about.
Who was that?
Well, guys like John Faso, for example, we don't know where he is, but he's in the 19th district. He's going to be up for re-election in 2018. He voted with the president. I don't know why he did that. But
I don't know what we're arguing about.
What
is the issue?
Who was that? Senator Dean Heller.
What premise are you?
The Washington Post is saying that there was a marriage between the Trump and the Republicans, and I'm saying Trump ran against the establishment.
Oh,
And that included both the Republicans and the Democrats. And that's what you guys don't get about his base. I know that you, the base is we're all just deplorable racist haters. But one of the things, in addition to all that, we were also against the idea that you have this establishment that is doing nothing to move the country forward. And that includes most of the Republicans.
Yeah. Well, no, let's do it this way, Rich. If it were a Democrat behaving in the way that Donald Trump is behaving, the Republicans would have been vociferous in their attacks against him.
Because they're the same thing.
About his personal behavior.
You're absolutely
about
right.
All of these allegations.
Yes.
And they have not been. They have, for the most part, with the exception of Lindsey Graham, and even that has been tempered,
and that's
John McCain,
new.
And that's new.
That's relatively new.
They have held their fire amidst activities that it just is unconscionable that they've held their fire, but they have because they're in a marriage of convenience.
We were talking about her earlier. Go ahead.
And so people like Dean Heller from Nevada, who then what happens to him? He's running in a tight election, and he holds his fire, and then he speaks up because he's trying to win his election, and then Trump team runs ads against their own Republican brethren.
So let me move beyond the semantics here and ask Alan what his feelings are about this relationship between the GOP and Trump, and can it be saved?
First of all, we have always posited on this program that I've always said when it gets into the 20s, they're going to say, save yourself, everybody.
Right.
Everybody is able to save themselves.
And they being the House and Senate.
The Republicans in both houses. I think that the break came sooner than I expected. I think that's what's happening.
When you edit a statement on Air Force One.
I think, to be respectfully, Rich, I think you just took another load away. You could tell by the smell it wasn't hay. Anyway, but the Republicans were with Trump. They are now saying the American people expect us to get together with the Democrats and to do what's right here, and they are doing that. And you can tell me anything you want about how Trump ran, Rich, but Trump ran on against Goldman Sachs. Remember that? He was talking about how bad Goldman Sachs was. Now, you go to the White House, all you see is Goldman Sachs. So it doesn't mean, nothing he's ever said means an awful lot.
If you are making the Republicans, the Republicans started backing Trump about 10 minutes after he won the election. Okay, if you remember the election.
So
half the Republicans weren't with him until after he won the election.
So what?
So my point is they were never. You guys, you're making it seem like there's some break in the relationship. There was
there
a
is.
Relationship.
There is. They were all behind him in this healthcare
thing.
And
I think
thing.
It came
they
when
they were behind him when they thought it was in their interest, and they were behind him when they thought they could do some kind of namby-pamby health plan that wasn't going to include them actually delivering on their promises. And then when that didn't happen, now they all start pointing at him.
Well, I think you're seeing a difference now policy-wise. I think you're now the help committee, the Senate committee that does healthcare. His schedule
this
series
is
of hearings on healthcare. You saw it yesterday in the Superfund hearings where there was a more bipartisan approach to the Superfund hearings. You saw it yesterday in the Senate Finance Committee where they had a more bipartisan approach to their focus on housing policy. There is a definite change, and I think that Trump attacking Sessions was a big issue. Trump attacking Murkowski, sending Zinke to threaten Murkowski. I think that the Trump people going after and running ads against their colleagues, you know, he's and his numbers going down.
One last thing here. Let me just say, when Trump beat Hillary, he said, "That was good. I beat Hillary." He couldn't ever make the transition into being an effective president of the United States. So he kept invoking Hillary, the election, again and again and again and again. And that's what ruined it, because when the Republicans and Democrats had some sense that they could do something together, he had to go back to that original scene of his first political success and build on that. That's what's going on here.
But I also think that the Senate Republicans and House Republicans understand that there's some very important work that needs to be done in the next few weeks. They have to, and I'm not sure how they're going to do this, they have to deal with the debt limit, they have to deal with the budget.
Half a minute, go ahead.
And he hasn't signed the Iran sanctions, I mean the North Korea sanctions bill yet. They have to deal with North Korea.
I think the real thing that's happening, Teresa and Alan, is that Congress has seen finally that they have stymied themselves into oblivion. They have made themselves irrelevant, and that Trump, just like Obama, is going to continue doing his things without them, just like Obama did. Trump's doing
but
the
that's
same
a change,
thing.
Right? Isn't that a change?
No, the only change is now they've realized if they don't start trying to do something legislatively, they're going to become totally irrelevant.
No, they realize that there are threats to the basic structures of our democracy and how our democracy functions,
and they're trying to bring back some normalcy to protect our government.
Teresa,
they realize finally that there's a threat to their relevance in the government, and they're trying to do something to make themselves
now,
heard.
Teresa.
We're out of time, actually. So you'll have to come back tomorrow, Teresa.
Indeed, I will.
All right. Excellent. So we'll start there. Rich will be back next week. We'll have to bargain that.
No, you can bargain
yourself.
Depends
on how North
quite
Korea
well
goes.
Today.
We'll still have a country next week.
All right. My thanks to everybody for joining us. We will be back with more Roundtable after this.